Well, hello, my name is Richard Clem, and welcome to my review course for the Multi-State Professional Responsibility Exam. I've given this same program hundreds of times in the past as a continuing legal education program for attorneys, and when I give the program that way, I usually branch off and mention amendments that have been made in different states that have adopted these rules. Today, on the other hand, we're just going to start plodding through the ABA Model Rules of Professional Conduct. We will just tell you what the rules say, but I think in the course of this program, you will get everything that you need to pass the exam, because virtually everything on the test is just an application of the rules. So having the familiarity with the rules, I think, will get you through the exam with flying colors. So with no further ado, we're going to jump right into the rules. We have a lot of material to cover, and we're just going to jump right in. We'll start with Rule 1.0, which contains a relatively long list of definitions. And I encourage you just to read through the model rules and make sure that you're familiar with those definitions. In most cases, I will be covering the terms as we address them in the actual rules, rather than stop to plod through the definitions, because in most cases, these words have their ordinary dictionary definition, and there aren't any major surprises there. But in a few cases, it might be worth taking a look at. But like I say, I wouldn't, don't fret too much over the actual definition of the rules. The one that I will cover right now, because it obviously comes up in a number of places, is the definition of writing. And Rule 1.0 makes clear that writing can include any tangible or electronic record, including an audio or video recording. So, for example, today's CLE, since you're listening to it as an audio recording, is a writing within the meaning of the rules. Similarly, a signature or signing of a document. For rule says that an agreement must be signed by the client. Well, that can be their signature with a pen, but it can also include any sound, symbol, or process adopted by the person with intent to sign. So if the person, in an audio recording, if I utter the words right now, yes, I agree to sign this document, well, that probably, given the circumstances, would constitute signing this electronic document. So that rule is pretty broad. Well, with that, we will jump right into the rules themselves, and we begin with Rule 1.1. This one I think is probably relatively difficult to include as a question on the exam, because it merely says that you as an attorney have to be competent. There's not a lot of there's unfortunately no solid definition of what competence means. So obviously you have to recognize that if in one of the exam questions the attorney in the question is providing an incompetent representation, well, obviously, in addition to whatever malpractice liability might attach, that is also a violation of Rule 1.1, which merely says that you as an attorney have to be competent when you're representing people. Again, it doesn't define the word competence, but it tells you some of the factors that go into that. So again, if there's a question of competence, look for some of these being missing. Competence requires having legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and the amount of preparation that's reasonably necessary for the case. On the other hand, watch out, just because the fact pattern says that this is the attorney's first case in a certain area, well, that doesn't necessarily make him or her incompetent, because as the ABA comment to this rule makes clear, that long experience in some particular field might not be necessary. So you can always have your first case. So after you pass the bar exam, which you're going to do, and you get out there in the practice of law and you have your first drunk driving case, or you have your first personal injury case, well, you're certainly able to be competent in that first case. But in those cases, you might need to acquire the requisite level of competence by reasonable preparation for that case. So that's the first rule, that you have to be competent. Rule 1.2, I think we'll take a little bit closer look at, because I think, in my opinion, this is probably the most important rule, Rule 1.2. because it says that you as an attorney shall abide by a client's decisions, period. Now, there's actually not a period in the rules because there's some exceptions right away and there's some other stuff. I just want to put that period there to make clear that there are not necessarily a lot of exceptions to that. There are not very many exceptions at all. It has to be in one of the specific exceptions. You as an attorney shall abide by a client's decisions, period. So in other words, if your client wants to do something foolish, if your client wants to do something unwise, well, that's your client's decision ultimately. Now, there are a number of things you can do. Now, first of all, because you're competent, in our last rule, you're supposed to, you know, you're probably supposed to try to talk your client out of doing the foolish thing. But if that fails, you certainly can't go behind the client's back and go opposite their wishes, because you must abide by your client's decisions. Now, later on, we'll get to an exception if your client has a diminished capacity of some kind. But in general, no, you have to abide by their client's decisions. You have to abide by their decisions in major matters, and you have to abide by their decisions in minor things. You have to abide by their decisions when they're right, and you have to abide by their decisions when they're wrong. Again, subject to some exceptions, like somebody with a diminished capacity, or maybe, as we'll learn later on, maybe you can just quit. But as long as you're representing the person, you must abide by their decisions, period. And you have to let the client know how those things are going to be carried out, which we'll actually talk about a little bit more in a later rule. Now you don't have to ask them every single thing. You don't have to take their instructions for every tiny little matter, unless they tell you that, if whatever steps are impliedly authorized to carry out those decisions. So they tell you that they want to file the lawsuit. You don't have to ask them what size paper that you should print the complaint on and things like that, because those things are impliedly authorized for you to do. But you have to abide by their decisions. Now, the rule goes on to say that, it's their decisions, therefore you as a lawyer are not endorsing what they are going to do. What you do does not constitute an endorsement of the client's political, economic, social, or moral views or activities. The rule makes abundantly clear, even though this kind of fits in with the general rule, is that obviously you have to abide by the client's decision, especially when it comes to whether or not to settle a case and whether to plead guilty or whether to plead not guilty. But that kind of goes without saying, because you have to abide by their decision about everything. But the rule just reiterates that. Now, one of the exceptions comes up right away. Fortunately, this doesn't come up too often in the day-to-day practice of law, but probably comes up on the test, because your professors always like talking about this hypothetical, and they like putting this kind of hypothetical on the test. One of the exceptions is that you can't help your client engage in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. So your client comes in and says, hey, lawyer, can you help me rob the bank? Well, obviously you can't do that, because you can't engage in or assist in conduct if you know that conduct to be criminal or fraudulent. That's an exception to the rule about abiding by the client's decisions. If the client's decision is help me commit this crime, well, then you're supposed to say no. And that's pretty easy. You already knew that. You're a moral person. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gone to law school. So you already knew that. We don't have to explain that. That's pretty easy. The next step is a little bit harder, though, because, that's an exception to the rule, but there's an exception to the exception. What you may do is discuss the legal consequences of some proposed course of conduct in order to help your client determine the scope, meaning, or application of the law. And the hypothetical I give for that, and I reassure the attorneys taking my program that this is just a hypothetical. It didn't really happen, so I hope the NSA doesn't come knocking on my door. The hypothetical I give here is a few months ago I got a phone call from this government employee in Hawaii. Government contractor. He worked for the government in Hawaii. He had a pretty good paying job. One of the conditions of his job, though, was that he was not allowed to travel outside the United States without getting his boss's permission first. And he called me up and said that he intended to do exactly that. And I said, well, I can't help you because, you know, you just told me that that's a crime. He said, well, but I just want some information. Does the United States have an extradition treaty with Hong Kong? So I went down to the library and determined that, lo and behold, yes, the U.S. Has an extradition treaty with Hong Kong, but that treaty says that if the U.S. government wants to act under it, they have to do everything perfectly. They have to dot every I, cross every T, everything has to be absolutely perfect. Otherwise, the Hong Kong authorities will just throw it back and say, no, we're not going to abide by this until you correct these tiny little errors. So I explained that to the client, that the extradition treaty says the United States has to do everything just perfectly, and they're never able to do that the first time. So if he goes to Hong Kong and they try to extradite him, he'll have plenty of time to travel to a third country. So I gave him that information, and lo and behold, what did he do? He went and flew to Hong Kong in violation of law. Well, I think I was probably okay, because I think I came under that exception to the exception in that hypothetical situation, since we're part of the NSA download here. I simply gave him the legal consequences of his proposed course of conduct and let him make that decision. Now, if he next asked me, well, great, can you give me the ride to the airport? Well, then I have to say no to that, because at that point, well, I'm assisting him in a conduct that I know is criminal or fraudulent. But merely sharing that information so that he can make a good faith determination of the scope, meaning, or application of the law, that is fine. Finally, Rule 1.2 says that you as a lawyer may limit the scope of a representation if it's reasonable and if the client gives informed consent. So just because somebody walks into your office doesn't mean that you're taking on all of their legal problems for the rest of their life. You may limit the scope of the representation. Person who has criminal charges and a civil case pending against him comes in and you tell him, well, I'm limiting the scope of the representation. I'm only going to take your civil case. I'm not going to represent you in the criminal matter. Well, that's okay. First of all, it has to be reasonable. Yeah, in that case, it sounds pretty reasonable. And number two, the client has to give informed consent. The client does have to consent to that, and it has to be informed consent. So anytime you limit the scope of representation, you have to watch and make sure that those two elements are there. It must be reasonable and there must be informed consent. Rule 1.3 is probably pretty hard to test on the exam exactly what this means, because here I'm just going to read the rule to you. So you're probably not going to get much money's worth. Well, it's a good thing that this is part of the free sample portion of the program here, Rule 1.3, because I'm really not going to tell you anything that you didn't already know. I'm just going to read the rule. It says, you shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. In other words, you should not procrastinate when it comes down to representing a client. So again, probably kind of hard to test on it, but obviously, if you see a fact pattern where a lawyer is just lackadaisical and not doing anything and just procrastinating, well, then obviously that's a violation of Rule 1.3. Well, what do lawyers procrastinate most often about? Well, they probably procrastinate about Rule 1.4, the next rule, namely communication. And I tell the lawyers who take this program, this doesn't help you too much on the exam, but to stay out of trouble, just over-communicate, because you'll never get into trouble for over-communicating, but you will definitely get into trouble for under-communicating. On this rule, I just tell the lawyers taking the course, just err on the side of caution. But you can't really do that on the test, because the test is going to ask you, is this lawyer subject to discipline for doing this? And you have to decide whether he is or not. If one of the answers is, the lawyer could have avoided this whole mess just by communicating more, well, then that's the right answer. But that's probably not one of the multiple choice answers. So for the test, you have to know the actual situations where you have to communicate. And some of these are kind of the general rule. I guess 2, 3, and 4 are kind of your general obligations. You have to tell the client how their objectives are going to be carried out. Tell the client, I'll take care of this. Well, you have to give them some idea of how you're going to do it. We're going to go to court, or we're going to we're going to plead, or, you know, we're going to throw ourselves on the mercy of the court. You know, you have to give them some idea of how those objectives are going to be carried out. You have to keep them informed about the status of the matter. That's probably the biggest one for initial contact with state bars, is the lawyer not keeping the client informed about the status of the matter. So keep the client up to date about the status of their case. And you have to also comply with reasonable requests for information. So if the client, those little pink phone messages that lawyers get, you have to return those calls to keep the client informed and answer their reasonable requests for information. So again, those are kind of the general obligation that always applies. Tell them how their objectives are going to be carried out. Keep them informed of the status and comply with reasonable requests for information. There are also two specific rules that come into play in specific situations, and on my list here in the written materials, they're numbers 1 and 5. First of all, anytime the client needs to consent to something, because a conflict of interest or something, well, they can consent to that. Or, they consented to limiting the scope of the representation back in Rule 1.2. There are a lot of things where people can consent. Well, keep in mind, anytime you see one of those rules involving consent, that's also going to involve communication. Because how can they consent if they didn't communicate it? So you look through the fact pattern and say, well, yeah, there would have been an exception for this conflict of interest if the person consented to it. So yeah, I guess they probably consented to it. So that's what I'll give my answer. Well, no, you can't give that answer unless there was communication. They had to say, yes, I consent. So anytime you see the word consent, make sure that you look for that communication that is a requisite part of any kind of consent. And obviously, if it's informed consent, you have to communicate the information. So that's the one specific situation where there has to be communication anytime the rules call for consent. Finally, you have to let the client know about any relevant limitations on your conduct. If the client is going to expect something that you're not allowed to do. So, for example, the fact pattern says, might imply that, you are admitted to practice law in New York, and you could file the case in New York. That would be a perfectly acceptable place to do it. But maybe you have a little bit better cause of action if you file the case in California. And maybe the client somehow in the fact pattern expects you to file that lawsuit in California, but you're not admitted to practice law in California. So in that situation, you would have to inform the client, well, I can file this case in New York, but I have to let you know about a relevant limitation on my conduct. Namely, I'm not admitted in this other state where I might reasonably expect that you would think, or you might reasonably expect a lawyer to consider filing it. So you'd have to let them know of that relevant limitation. More often than not, this letting them know about a relevant limitation probably involves a conflict of interest, which we'll be talking about in a little bit more detail later. And that, because obviously conflicts of interest always give rise to a limitation on your conduct. So that would be one where you would have to keep them informed. Now, how do you know, in some of those iffy questions, how do you know if that you've communicated enough information, kind of under that general obligation, how their objectives are going to be carried out, keep them informed of the status of the matter, comply with their reasonable requests for information. Well, the test, if you have a close call on that, the test of whether the lawyer has met his or her obligation to communicate is, does the client have enough information so that they can intelligently participate in decisions? So remember, I said a few minutes ago that Rule 1.2 was the most important rule because it's the rule that says the client makes all the decisions. Well, this is an example of something relating back to that. That is the test of whether or not you've communicated enough. You have communicated enough if the client has enough information now so that they can intelligently make those decisions, which are theirs to make. But if they're kind of in the dark and they don't have enough information to make those decisions, well, then you have not communicated enough because those decisions are theirs to make. So rule 1.4. Now, all of these rules, starting with a 1, talk about the attorney-client relationship, mostly the duties that you owe to the client. The next one is, the client owes a duty to you to pay you. And yes, we are allowed to charge people money. We don't have to take everything on a pro bono basis. You have bills to pay, and we can send our client a bill. We can ask for money in exchange for representing people. And the restriction, though, under Rule 1.5 is that our fees can't be unreasonable. It doesn't say they have to be reasonable. It says they can't be unreasonable. So I guess that gives us maybe a little bit, more of a buffer zone, kind of puts the burden of proof on the other side to show that they're unreasonable. But our fees can't be unreasonable. Now, unfortunately, the word reasonable is not defined. If you've been through a couple of years of law school, you've probably figured out by now that the word reasonable is never defined. But at least here they give you a number of factors to look at to decide whether or not the fee is reasonable. So look for these factors in the fact pattern. The amount of time and labor required. Well, that's probably an easy one. Obviously, you can charge by the hour. And, it's reasonable to charge more for the 3-hour case than you did for the 1-hour case, obviously. The novelty and difficulty of the case is a relevant factor. So consumer bankruptcy, you can only charge a certain amount. But, if the city of Detroit walks into your office because they want to file for bankruptcy, that's probably a little bit more novel in a little bit more difficult situation, so you can probably get away with charging them a little bit more, or maybe a lot more. Another factor is whether that case will prevent you from taking on other employment. So if you're going to be booked up full-time dealing with this person's legal needs, you can take that into consideration when you set your fee. The customary charge in the locality is another relevant factor. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to match the price of the lawyers across town, but if every lawyer in town is charging $1,000 for a particular matter and you're charging $10,000, that's probably evidence that it's unreasonable. The amount involved and the results obtained. So if you, you have a lot of work on a case and it's, billing a lot, but it's some trivially small case, that might be unreasonable. You charge them, $1,000 to collect $100, that might be unreasonable, even though you put in $1,000 worth of your time. Time limitations are relevant. So they walk into your office the night before the statute of limitations is about to run out, and they need you to file something right away, and you have to drop everything and tend to their needs. That's a relevant factor on whether or not the fee is reasonable. The nature and length of the relationship with the client is another factor deciding whether or not it's reasonable. What the rule is talking about is a long-term sophisticated client, you can probably get away with charging more than a brand new unsophisticated client who just walked in off the street. It probably would not be reasonable to charge the same amount to that person. Whereas a client who's a sophisticated business person who's been your client for a long time, then there's less chance that they're going to look into whether the fee to that person is reasonable. They're kind of better able to fend for themselves. Your experience and reputation is a relevant factor. So if you've been in practice for 20 years and you are well known in the legal community, then you can get away with charging more. Finally, whether or not your fee is a fixed fee or a contingent fee. We will talk about contingent fees in a while, but you can charge more in a contingent fee situation than you would if the fee is fixed. And again, we'll talk about contingent fees in a minute. Then after listing all those factors, then the rules go on to say, there might be other factors out there too. So that's not necessarily an exclusive list. The next part of this rule, and the lawyers who take this program, I tell them this is an easy one to violate, so watch out for this, and it would be an easy one to put on the test too. So I would kind of expect a question about this. And this rule says that the fee and scope of representation must be communicated to the client, preferably in writing, before starting or within a reasonable time. Now, some states word that a little bit differently. Some states have a little bit of a leeway, but you can't just accrue a large bill and send the bill to the client. You have to communicate that fee information in writing. Well, not just a large bill, a small bill, because it doesn't say here about the size of the fee. So that's why I warn attorneys to watch out for this if they. If they just get to work on some small matter with a, that they're not going to charge very much and they charge a very reasonable fee, well, they're still violating this if they didn't communicate that fee information, preferably in writing and before starting or within a reasonable time after starting. So don't just present your client with a bill after the fact. Communicate that fee information up front and again, preferably in writing. So if that writing is lacking, that's a fact pattern. It would probably be pretty easy to make a test question out of. Now, on the other hand, if it's an existing client and you were working for X dollars an hour before, it's kind of understood that you're going to continue working for X dollars an hour on this new matter. But if you change that, if there's a change from the fee structure, you have to let them know. Now, contingent fee. As I mentioned before, yes, you can have contingent fees. Now, when you get out in practice, so when you think of a contingent fee, most attorneys who think of a contingent fee think of 1/3 in a civil case or something. You get $9 million, so the lawyer gets $3 million, and that's one type of contingent fee. But keep in mind that a contingent fee means any time you get a different fee depending upon a different outcome of the case. So if you're going to get more or less money depending on what happens in the case, then it's a contingent fee, and you have to make sure that you're following the rules here. The main rule is that contingent fee agreements have to be in writing. You cannot have an oral contract for a contingent fee. That's a violation of the rules. It has to be in writing and it has to be signed by the client. As we mentioned in the definition of writing and signed, well, that's kind of pretty broad, so I guess it could be something other than a piece of paper, but it does have to be a writing and it does have to be signed by the client. There are certain things that have to be in the contract. Those are, they have to describe the method by which the fee is going to be determined. So it has to say, I will get 1/3 of this, or I'll get, X dollars if we win, Z dollars if we lose, whatever. It has to be specified in there how that fee is calculated. If that differs in the case of a settlement, trial, or appeal, all of those specific percentages have to be listed in there. What expenses will be deducted? Who, how the question of expenses are going to be taken care of. And also, just to avoid ambiguity, you have to put in the contract specifically whether you take out those expenses before or after you calculate the percentage. And it has to clearly identify the expenses for which the client is going to be responsible, even if they don't prevail. So if there are situations where the client's going to have to cover certain expenses, either because that's just what you want, or because maybe there's a court rule saying that the client is always responsible for this kind of expense, well, that information has to be included in the contract, and they have to be clearly identified. After the case is over, then you have to give a prompt statement to the client, and you have to promptly show them how the remittance is going to be broken down. So when you get this $9 million settlement, you have to give a detailed statement showing, that's, well, it's $9 million minus $1 million in expenses equals $8 million times 0.333 equals, this many dollars for me, and the remainder goes to you. So you have to have that detailed statement. And then finally, there are two kinds of cases where contingent fees are not allowed. Those are family law cases and criminal cases. Now, keep in mind, a contingent fee means any time your fee varies depending upon the outcome of the case. So it's, it's not just, in a family law case, custody of three kids. So the lawyer gets one of those three kids. That would be a contingent fee and not allowed. But anytime, if obviously a percentage of the alimony, you can't take that, because that would be a contingent fee in a family law case. But also it would be a contingent fee in a family law case, something along the lines of, I won't charge you anything unless we get this temporary restraining order against your spouse. That would be a contingent fee in a family law case, because your fee depends upon the result of the case. And similarly in criminal cases, it's not just one third, so the client gets 30 years, so the lawyer gets 10 years. That would be a contingent fee, but it's, the definition is broader than that. The extreme case would be no fee unless you are acquitted. That would be a contingent fee in a criminal case, and that would not be permitted. The leading case in this comes from the state of Wisconsin, where the Wisconsin Supreme Court held that it was improper for the lawyer to do this. The lawyer was advertising he represented drunk driving defendants, and he was advertising that if he didn't win your case, he would give you a free bicycle. So it was a great advertising gimmick as far as I'm concerned, because your transportation needs are all taken care of one way or another. This lawyer just wins the case hands down, and it's like it never happened, and you get on with your life and keep driving to work. Or, things don't go quite so well, and you wind up in without a car or without a driver's license or something. In that case, at least your transportation needs are taken care of, because you have this brand new bicycle that you can use to get from place to place. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court looked at that and said, no, that's a contingent fee in a criminal case, because you are charging a certain fee. But in cases in which you lose, you are charging that fee minus the cost of this bicycle. And that is enough to be held to be a contingent fee in a criminal case, and not permitted in Wisconsin, probably not permitted anywhere. In fact, I think that one has been on the test before, so watch out for that one. That's not permitted. Finally, Rule 1.5 talks about fee splitting. Now, later on in the program, it's in, I think it's Rule 7.2 or something, where we get to the part that says you're not supposed to pay referral fees. You are never supposed to pay anybody anything of value for referring a case. So that's, like I say, we'll get to that rule later on. So you never, never, never allowed a referral fee. And I tell the lawyers to take the case, some of them do it, but for heaven's sake, don't call it that, because you're admitting guilt. But there are some cases, though, where you're going to split the fee with another attorney. If I have a personal injury case walk into my office and I send them to the big personal injury firm downtown, then I will get in a lot of trouble if I accept a referral fee for sending it to that firm. But on the other hand, it's perfectly permissible. It's a good thing if I work in conjunction with another attorney. So you get out of law school, I hire you to assist me in this case. You do half the work, I do half the work. It's reasonable. I'm going to get half the pay and you're going to get half the pay. We can work together. We can share the fee. That's certainly okay. And that's what this rule is recognizing here. That yes, it is okay to split the fees between more than one attorney. But when you do that, it has to be in proportion to the services provided by each lawyer. Now, some states don't like that word proportion in there, so they've kind of moved away from that. But I don't think the rule itself implies that it has to be a strict, I put in 41.7 of the hours, so I'm going to get 41.7 percent of the money in the case. I don't think it has to be mathematical precision like that, but in general, it has to be in proportion to the amount of work that I did. I can't get paid way more than the hours I put in, Because then it's really just a referral fee and we're just pretending that it's something else. So, but as long as it's in proportion to the amount of work that I provided, then it's okay. Or, and this is the one that the lawyers always hang their hat on when they're trying to get a referral fee and pretend it's something else. But it is permissible that I can split the fee with another attorney if I maintain responsibility for the case. So in other words, my client is paying me to maintain that responsibility. I do find the big personal injury firm downtown and send the case down there, but I maintain responsibility. I continue to sign all the pleadings in the case, or some of the pleadings in the case. The client continues to have communication with me, and most importantly, if that big personal injury firm downtown screws up, my client can sue me for their malpractice, because I am maintaining responsibility in the case. So that's kind of the test of whether or not I'm maintaining responsibility for purpose of this rule. In that agreement I have with the big firm downtown, if I put in a lot of weasel words in there to make sure that I don't get myself sued, well, then I'm probably violating this rule by engaging in fee splitting, because then it's probably just a referral fee. So the test of this is whether or not the fee is reasonable to the client. So if you have one of these fact patterns where the fee is being split, you have to look at the fee being received by this attorney and ask yourself, did the client get that much value out of this lawyer's services in the case, either from the amount of work he did or from the amount of responsibility that he or she maintained in the case? If you can answer that question, yes, that, well, yeah, this lawyer got $10,000, but that client got $10,000 worth of value out of it. If you can answer that question, yes, then the fee splitting arrangement is okay. On the other hand, if you're forced to say, well, you know, the client didn't really get that much value, but this other attorney who got this lucrative case sent to their office, he sure got a lot of value, so I guess it's okay. Well, no, it's not okay in that case, because that's prohibited by Rule 7.2, because that's a referral fee, and you're not allowed to do referral fees. So you have to always look at, did the client get value out of this arrangement? Finally, anytime there is a kind of a fee-splitting arrangement, the client has to agree to it. That has to be in writing. Again, that the definition of writing is pretty broad, includes a lot of other things. And that agreement has to specify what proportion each lawyer will get. And, of course, the entire overall fee has to be reasonable as well. So, that's an easy one to put on the test. So make sure, I would probably take another look at Rule 1.5 the night before the test, because there's almost certain to be a few questions on that. But it has to be, again, in proportion to the services provided or in cases in which you both maintain responsibility. Well, that brings us up to the end of Rule 1.5, and it also brings us to the end of Part 1 of this program. Part 2 of the program will continue with a discussion of Rule 1.6, confidentiality. So thank you once again for listening. If more information about this program, if you got this sample that you're listening to, you wonder where it came from, my name is Richard Clem. You can find my website, richardclem.com. I'm an attorney in Minnesota and also a continuing legal education provider, and making this course available for students studying for the MPRE. And I have more information about how to get the other parts on my website, which once again is richardclem, RICHARDCLEM, all one word, .com. And on my front page, you'll see a link to my MPRE page. So thank you once again. Good luck on the test, and I look forward to seeing you at the remaining parts of this program. Have a great day.